Hey there, podcast listeners. I love using NovoPsych, which is why I'm really pleased for them to come on as a sponsor to our show. NovoPsych is the ultimate tool for administering psychological questionnaires, tracking outcomes, and informing treatment. With NovoPsych, you can easily access a wide range of evidence-based questionnaires and assessment tools. There's no more time-consuming scoring. It's all done very easily and automatically. There's over 100 psychometric tools available. NovoPsych has assessments for specific things like trauma, personality, and many other presenting issues that will really help a schema therapist understand complex presentations. What I really like is having all your client data securely stored in one place. It has really cool graphs and clear visualizations, which clients really like too. So if you're ready to enhance your practice, visit NovoPsych.com today and start your free trial.
Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to What's the Schemata, the podcast that's specifically designed for those that are learning and want to know more about the practice of schema therapy. And today we have a fantastic episode focusing on eating disorders. We're with Dr. Susan Simpson, who is really one of the leading experts in the application of schema therapy and eating disorders. She's originally from Australia, but lives in Scotland. Rob had the pleasure of meeting with Susan and talking shop for a good part of an hour. So we really do hope you enjoy this episode, and we look forward to maybe meeting you in future trainings. We have a number of trainings this year, live trainings within Australia, and you might be interested in seeing our website, www.schematherapytraining.com. Alternatively, you might be interested in completing some online training, and some of our training is live and some of it's pre-recorded, and that is available on schematherapytrainingonline.com. So without further ado.
Okay, Susan, welcome Simpson, everyone, to this webinar with Dr. Susan Simpson, who's tuning in from Scotland. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks,
welcome,
Rob.
Welcome. Nice to see you again. You know, Susan does so much work within the schema therapy community on different things, and especially in the domain of eating disorders. She also runs our eating disorders course, the online course at schematherapytrainingonline.com. And, you know, we haven't spoken to Susan about eating disorders for at least a couple of years now. I want to say even 3 years. I think we might have did something during COVID. And I think it's a really rapidly shifting space, and partly because, you know, for my own education, I thought we'd get back on and hear about what's happening with eating disorders. And I know a lot of people like to hear about it. So, Susan, over to you, if you could present some of this sort of eating disorders update for about the next hour. And we've got this format today, guys, where Susan's going to be conducting the webinar, and I'm going to come in from time to time and sort of engage us with some questions and things. So over to you, Susan.
Great. Thanks, Rob. Yeah, so I thought today I would talk a little bit more about comorbidities. Often when we're working with eating disorders, we're working with everything. And I think there are so many different comorbidities that impact on outcomes with people with eating disorders, and really that we need to take into account within our schema therapy formulation. In particular, I think looking at trauma, complex trauma in particular, and how trauma and dissociation can impact on body image. So I just thought I'd touch a little bit on those topics. And this is something I'll probably be kind of adding to the schema therapy training online course as well, with some of these additional modules at some point. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about this, because I spend a lot of time down rabbit holes thinking about these topics, reading the research and so forth. So what I'd like to do to start with is just look in general at what the comorbidities are for people with eating disorders, and then we'll go into a bit more depth, kind of looking at the trauma side of things and body image. For anyone working in eating disorders, you're probably already aware that many people, over half of people with eating disorders experience some kind of depressive difficulties, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, extremely common, from generalized anxiety disorder, social phobia, social anxiety, extremely common, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, health-related anxieties, so a whole range of anxiety disorders. And of course, these are also linked to temperament, which we won't have time to go into in this webinar, but temperament is another huge rabbit hole in the eating disorder area, because of course, temperament does impact on, I guess, the degree to which our childhoods impact on us and the way that we cope with those childhood experiences. So alcohol and substance misuse, also very common, and especially in people with, well, I was going to say especially in people with bulimic disorders, but also anorexia nervosa and bipolar disorder, also relatively common in this population. Also, you might already be aware, personality disorders, very common in people with eating disorders, and in particular for restrictive anorexia, binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa, we get high levels of obsessive compulsive disorder, avoidant and dependent personality disorder. And in bulimia nervosa and binge purge anorexia nervosa, higher levels of borderline personality disorder and other personality disorders in the cluster B. So we kind of get this, over-controlled eating disorders that align with kind of over-controlled personality disorders, and under-controlled eating disorders where there's more kind of mode flipping, if you like, that are at high comorbidity with kind of cluster B personality disorders.
Can I just jump in for a second, Susan? Oh. Actually, there's lots of cool sort of stats that you're flashing up here, and I know some people might be listening in on the pod on audio. So is it okay? You're going to share a PDF of these with us?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah? Okay, and we'll post them. We'll post them on the main site, on the schematherapytraining.com site, and then just you have to find the pod and you'll see the show notes in there. Over to you.
Right. Neurodiversity, also very common for people with autism and ADHD to experience eating disorders, very high comorbidity of autism with especially restrictive anorexia nervosa, and often underdiagnosed, not picked up in childhood, but often kids who feel different, feel like they don't fit in, and often have that experience of no one really understanding them, no one really getting what's going on for them and giving them the support that they need to understand themselves and to understand what they need. And ADHD, particularly high amongst people with binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa. So again, tend to be quite underdiagnosed. Now let's kind of drill down on trauma. And of course, we know that trauma is one of the major factors, if not the major factor, linked to personality disorder. So this kind of ties in with comorbidity with personality disorders. I think when we're looking at trauma, we're looking at big T trauma and little T trauma. This study by Barbara Bazil, which I really love, it's such a great study, which looked at using diagnostic imagery to uncover unmet needs and specific trauma experiences for people with eating disorders. And she found that she and her team found safety and protection, number one, unmet need, care and nurturance. Here we're talking about emotional deprivation, so lack of attunement and lack of emotional expression. So a lot of emotional constriction in the family, emotional inhibition, specifically linked to the maternal figure. So mothers were described as more abandoning and at the same time enmeshed in the relationship with their daughters. This is very, very common, this kind of often unresolved issues in the parents, that the parents' own schemas impact on their capacity to be attuned and to allow the child to develop a separate self and individuate because of their own unresolved stuff. Patients perceive their fathers as more emotionally inhibited and neglecting. So this is the kind of, I guess, backdrop through which we might look at some of the traumas that people with eating disorders experience. And generally, when we're looking at traumas in this population, we're looking at eating disorder specific, so eating and body related traumas, as well as non-specific traumas. So the food-related traumas, and those of you who work with people with eating disorders will know they tend to be, there's a whole range of things, from being kind of restricted access to food, deprived of food, food being used as a punishment, used as a way of manipulating or controlling the child, and withholding food if the child doesn't behave in a particular way, or just kind of complete neglect. And I'm thinking about a client I worked with who used to take raw sausages out of the fridge when she could, because there was just no food available at all. She was so starving so much of the time. So this, and often there's this overlap of deprivation of food and deprivation of love. So the two of these things often coexist. And interestingly, the research, the kind of neuroscience on this also is that kind of hunger, physical hunger, and the hunger around, emotional hunger around loneliness, originate from the same part of the brain as well. So often those two types of deprivation can become kind of wired together and very kind of confused and feel the same. So both can feel like physical hunger or physical pain.
It's so interesting, Susan. I was reading something today about culture, and it's actually a paper that we did for an Asian cultural context. We're running a chapter for this, but they were saying that this is in the paper, in Chinese culture, it's rarer that for expressions of love and sentiments like I love you and these kind of expressions in an Asian culture, rarer, and it's more uncomfortable or not something you see very often, but that they might be more likely to do things like make you a meal or make you soup or express their love in these kind of, I guess, acts of service type ways. But food being a big part of that. So it's funny you bring that up. I was only reading that today.
Right, exactly. So this is how I know I'm loved, you know, through, you know, these two areas become very overlapping, don't they? And this is how often for many people they learn, I know I'm loved if I'm fed or...
If you care about my food needs, that's a way of feeling right. Cared about, yeah. Right. Interesting. We don't usually see it that way in skin. We don't think about food deprivation, you know, the regular model.
Absolutely. And that can feel very unsafe, of course. If the child is very hungry and feels like, I don't know where my next meal is coming from, it's that kind of unmet need for kind of safety and survival as well. And often we see people as well who get stuck in that individuation, a kind of phase where, especially if they've been through a family-based therapy treatment where the emphasis is, of course, on the parent getting the child to eat. If they've developed an eating disorder in childhood, the parents kind of recruited to help the child eat. But sometimes where there's an enmeshment schema and these types of difficulties, the family becomes stuck in this becoming the only way the child can elicit care and connection and attention from the parent, that my parent sees that I'm very thin in the case of anorexia and feeds me. And that's how I know I'm cared for. And it's very difficult to let go of because, you know, especially if other types of affection are not on offer.
I've often thought too that there are some cases I've seen of really severe neglect where the parents might have had the mum had a schizophrenia or severe drug use or something. And there's been this period of a deprivation of food early on where there wasn't, you know, they're fending for themselves more or less. And they can get sort of food anxiety around, will there be enough? And in the children, there can be sort of hoarding of food and stealing of food and these kind of behaviors. So it does make me wonder about something like a slightly separate schema. It always felt a little bit like vulnerability to harm type thing.
That's interesting. I mean, often people with binge eating disorder who've had those types of experience, binge eating disorder or bulimia nervosa, who've had those types of experiences, describe this experience before a binge of this extreme hunger, this fear I need to get it while I can. I need to get as much as I can. So it's kind of like hoarding in the body because I don't know when I'm going to be punished and be deprived again. Mm. And there's, of course, that parallel process of if food is love, then I need to store up as much love as I can.
So there's a slightly two slightly angles on this. There's the nutriment threat type thing, and then there's more the sort of care connection piece around that. Would you go as far as to say that not that it's an official thing, but would you suspect there could be a very more specific schemas around this that are not in the full model at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And one of those also might be, which I'll potentially tap into a bit later, is kind of body mistrust, you know, that this body mistrust schema, which we could.
I don't trust my body. I don't trust my physical self.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you say more about it? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, yeah. So there's almost a fear of my own needs, fear of my own kind of vulnerability, my emotional experience. Often if there has been a lack of, obviously, a lack of anything, a lack of food or a lack of love or a lack of both, then there's this kind of craving and overwhelm and panic around it, and I guess a lack of a capacity to regulate those feelings and a sense of powerlessness, you know, in a very young child who's very hungry, either for connection, for touch, for warmth, for love, or for food, in where the child's maybe being punished for crying and being left in their cot and being left hungry. Yeah, there's this kind of fear of death. There's this overwhelming.
So you can see why what I was saying, it sort of feels often like a vulnerability to harm type thing, because it's very panicking. Like to think that you could go hungry is a massive threat, actually. Yeah, exactly. And it's a physical threat. It's in that physical realm, isn't it? It's my physical self is threatened.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, because there's so much deprivation, when the person does get a chance to access any of these things, the kind of physical or the emotional ingredients, then there's this kind of overwhelm, loss of control that happens, which kind of feeds into this sense that I can't
feed in. Body. Okay. There's a part, no pun intended. And there's always this, I guess oftentimes it's a case that there's got to be the cookies in the cupboard and there's got to be something there just in case sort of thing.
Right. 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 And I'll just leave them. I won't eat them. They're just there just in case. And that's very common in eating disorders and very, very common if there's been, food deprivation alongside emotional deprivation, that kind of very frugal environments.
I'd love to hear one day, like maybe you write it down or probably you do some research expanding the model in that way. If we found out somehow that there were more nuanced schemas in this range. Anyway, let's keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a lot of, I think, fear that develops in these early experiences where there isn't enough food or where it's just the child feels powerless to get the food when they need it. You know, they get home from school, the fridge is empty. I don't know when I'm going to get food again. It's just, or that the child is being punished for something and they go to school and they don't have lunch. And there's this sense of being controlled, their food intake being controlled by someone else. That becomes very, and can develop, the person can develop a lot of feelings of helplessness and powerlessness, but also a lot of fear and dysregulation in the body, which they're unable to manage themselves and no one else is potentially co-regulating them either. So they learn to be fearful of their own inner experience. So there's this food insecurity, forced feeding for some people have experienced this kind of forced feeding. And for patients with ARFID, so avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, where they've developed, and very common for people with autism as well to have this, where they have very strict sense of, you know, what they will eat and what they won't eat. They're very triggered by certain sensations, have a very strong disgust response to certain foods touching each other, common comorbidity with OCD as well. So kind of high levels of disgust around food that they've been forced to eat. And this kind of creates a lot of trauma and fear around food as well. So they develop an eating disorder on top of their kind of innate ARFID. We're also, the person might also experience other types of kind of sensory trauma, especially again for these people with ARFID or kind of picky eaters kind of thing. Interpersonal traumas, being bullied, being teased, very, very common, being ostracized, associated with body appearance. And often you'll see a picture of people who maybe have experienced a lot of deprivation and emotional deprivation and eat as a way of kind of coping with that and soothing themselves, because it's the only way that they've learned how to do that, because nobody else is soothing them. And then they'll gain weight and then they'll be bullied and teased. So they'll hang all of their difficulties, they'll make sense of their difficulties in terms of it's my body that's the problem, whereas actually it's the deprivation that was the original problem, that the kind of overwhelming hunger that's the problem. Body sexual objectification as well, you know, and being seen as a body. And this is a very cultural phenomenon, isn't it, where we're kind of not encouraged to be embodied and to experience life from within our bodies. From a certain age, we become kind of objectified within social media and so forth, and judged, our worth is kind of judged based on sexual attractiveness and so forth by certain external criteria. Okay. And then we've got the kind of, I guess, what we would call little t traumas, the kind of more hidden traumas, which are the what we were talking about before, the kind of emotional neglect, emotional, physical, educational neglect, emotional abuse, shaming and guilt-inducing messages. Parentification, again, this is part of enmeshment, which Barbara Bazile's study identified. Restriction of autonomy and individuation, very, very common. It's often referred to, and without kind of overgeneralizing, we're not talking here about everyone with an eating disorder, but this kind of affectionless control, that love is delivered in a package of kind of control and overprotectiveness, or over control and intrusiveness, with a lack of attunement, a lack of emotional warmth, a lack of overt care in terms of touch and affection. So, you know, if we look at, and we'll come onto this when we talk about interoception, but if there is a lack of attunement, if as a young infant, you know, the infant cries and the parent is not able to attune because of their own difficulties, and they're just kind of parenting based on a checklist. Okay, you're crying, it must be the nappy, or if you cry, and to some extent we all do that, of course, it's guesswork, but as we learn to become parents and we become attuned to our own child, we start to get a sense of, you know, what this child needs and what this cry might be about, and we become more attuned. And then we learn that the child learns, I'm crying and I'm feeling lonely or I'm feeling sad, and I get a hug and that meets that need, and I get this kind of sense of satisfaction from that. And I learn that this feeling in my body is linked to this feeling and is linked to this need, and this is how I get this need met, and this need is normal and okay, and it's okay for me to get that need. Whereas if those need, that attunement doesn't happen in a consistent and kind of semi-accurate way, then the child can't make sense of their own experiences. They feel distressed, but they don't know, what do I need? I don't know. I just know that I'm distressed because they're crying because they need a hug and they're getting food, or they're crying because they need food and they're getting a hug. You know, all those interoceptive signals become muddled and they're unable to read. If you think of the body as a book, they can't read their own book. So the body becomes a frightening place because it's where all the very overwhelming feelings are.
So a lot of these, Susan, there's obvious traumas at times, things like, you know, physical abuse and violence and things that are very obvious. But you're using the term hidden traumas here for things that might be more subtle or not as easy to pick up, or not as easy, maybe they think it's normal, or
right.
This is what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. These aren't necessarily offered to us on a platter at assessment with people with eating disorders. In fact, they're often hidden there, you know, and often it can take 6 months before you can, you know, really get the person, or more, before you can really get the person to acknowledge that maybe these things, you might be able to see it.
Rarely do the clients come in and say, you know, I've been adultified or parentified, right, or I had all these guilt-inducing messages growing up. they don't really present like that necessarily.
And what's more, the guilt-inducing messages part of the problem, because the guilt, they feel so guilty about allowing themselves to have needs, to take up space in the world, because the guilt-inducing messages have been crucial. Then that's I think a crucial part of the enmeshment schema, which is so common in this pop.
And that's tricky too, right? Because often they're not very explicit. Which they can be, but more often than not, those messages are more implicit in
right.
Mum's situation, her emotional overwhelm, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's huge anxiety and guilt around.
Like no one said you have to regulate mum, but if you didn't, things were unstable for a week in the house. So, you know, this is the message you got more implicitly. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so implicit and it's so automatic and often confusing as well, because the overt message from the parent might be quite different. It might be, come on, you know, you need to get out there and live your life. And, you know, I don't understand why you're holding back and you're staying home. But implicitly, the parent's giving a different message. You know, while you're out there, I have to stay here and do everything. I have to look after the dog. I have to, you know, do all the work. So there's this kind of, you know, this comes through on the text message and the client's kind of feeling guilty instantly, but it's kind of more covert, more implicit. And then they can say, but it's me, I'm the one that's holding myself back, because their parent is overtly telling them. Yeah. But the parent's not aware, of course, their own schemas in terms of consciously. The parent, of course, does want the child to go out and have a happy life. But, you know, usually the parent doesn't realize how impactful their own schemas are.
It's interesting what you just said too, because you're talking about guilt-inducing messages. You're also talking partly about very pressurizing messages around performance.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I've been playing around with an idea, like lately you find in some of these cases, very severe cases, the critic has all of these messages. Like it's just this kind of super critic with, you know, guilt-inducing messages and unrelenting standards and demanding messages and punitiveness all mixed in there into this sort of massive force that they're having to deal with. I mean, do you find that in eating disorders too?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like more often than not, it's not a clean sort of punitive critic. You know, you have sort of mixed bag of critic, you know. What do you think of that? I often call it the super critic when it's got all those features.
Yeah. I mean, I think, as you know, I tend to split it off into a kind of more of a coping mode part and a critic part. So kind of more of a kind of flagellating over controller part, which is more of a masochistic part that is more addicted to pain or to self.
If there's a coping part of that, if there's a flagellating part of that. But do you get that with your critics though, with your eating disorder clients, where they have a mixed critic, where it's, you know, you might have a demanding / guilt inducing, for example, where you know it's not just one sentiment; it's really got all those schemas in there.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a kind of high demand, conditional. The care when it's delivered is often conditional, so there's this kind of demanding bit, which is quite extreme. But the guilt inducing messages often do kind of evolve into kind of more of a punitive critic. So even if the person hasn't got overt punitive messages, the guilt-inducing messages are quite toxic and are more impactful, because whereas a kind of more punitive message, you can fight back. You can kind of say, to some extent, we know that that's wrong. We know that that's not okay when somebody says
it's not
this.
Okay to bully somebody like that, yeah.
Exactly. But if somebody uses your own conscience against you, you know, so it makes you feel like you've broken your
own
moral.
You've caused the pain. You're causing the pain of your mother, or you're causing the pain of these people. Yeah.
I'm suffering so much because of, you know, having to take care of you or whatever it is that the child feels like they've broken their own moral code. And that's a much more powerful way of controlling somebody and making them do whatever it is you need them to do. Yeah. Making them be good. Which means compliant generally. Now, this study, I think, was a really important one. This is an Australian group, Day et al., and they looked at complex PTSD and eating disorders. Now, PTSD, of course, plus disturbed self-organization is the complex PTSD. So it's these two parts. And often we associate PTSD with eating disorders, but this study found a third of individuals with eating disorder reported at least threshold PTSD symptoms. And this is of the people who will acknowledge it, because I find certainly clinically many people with anorexia nervosa don't tend to acknowledge any trauma until way down the track. It's just so suppressed, or you know, there's so much shame around it that they can't report it. So I think this is a massive kind of underreport. But over 50% reported disturbed self-organization, which would kind of overlap with personality disorder in a sense, that their sense of self is very fragmented. Their coping modes are very fragmented and dissociated. So in fact, complex PTSD is significantly more prevalent than PTSD in people with eating disorders. So this is really what we're looking for when we're working with people with eating disorders. Again, underreported, but it's everywhere. You know, there's just so much trauma in this population, and more common in higher levels of care. So people in, for example, day patient and inpatient tend to have higher levels of trauma. And that links, of course, to when there's high complex trauma, there's also often more severity of other psychiatric illnesses and eating disorders. And they are often more likely to end up in hospital. Very, very tricky to treat. And in particular, because there's just so much distress around processing the early trauma, and especially if it's pre-verbal trauma. Yeah, so disturbed self-organization symptom severity was a significant and unique explanatory factor of eating disorder severity and impairment, independent of PTSD symptoms. So this fragmentation of self, this lack of sense of self, and of course this links in again with the enmeshment schema and various other schemas that we've talked about in terms of this undeveloped self, which is kind of appearing as these different coping modes that the person is very strongly fused to. And often this is something other clinicians often say to me is, you know, how do we get past this overcontroller mode, or how do we get past this detached self-soother, that they're so strong, these modes, often because it is the only, this is what provides coherence. This is what provides a sense of self for someone whose sense of self has become so fragmented. And you can just see here, I've just flashed this up, but this is kind of all the different types of abuse that were identified in this sample. So you can see the kind of residential had higher levels of, well, across the board, higher levels of emotional abuse. And this is the literature, and there's a lot of research on this that is kind of talked about emotional abuse. Often emotional neglect, I find, is kind of hard to measure. So I don't think that is an accurate figure there for neglect, because the emotional deprivation schema on the YSQ, it's a tricky one to pick up sometimes on what we're talking about when we're talking about neglect. Okay, so yeah, as I said, complex PTSD, really, we're talking here about these kind of prolonged interpersonal traumas associated with attachment wounds, including abandonment, helplessness, betrayal, and linked to these kind of ongoing developmental impacts for children and adolescents. And in particular, linked to higher levels of dissociation, higher levels of perfectionism, kind of over-controlled coping mechanisms, compulsive pathology, rigid thinking, high levels of shame. So, yeah, specific schemas linked to the disconnection rejection domain seem to be particularly relevant: abandonment, mistrust, abuse, emotional deprivation, social isolation, and defectiveness. And these tend to be linked to kind of trauma experiences and higher eating disorder symptoms. Yeah, but as I say, keeping an eye out for emotional abuse and neglect, these are the ones that people tend to underreport. This is another few studies here which have found higher levels of neglect. Look at that, 66% in these studies. So really high in this population. And this is where we come back to this kind of emotional hunger, if you like, and emotional abuse around 20%. Now, if we look at all the different types of abuse, emotional abuse has got the greatest effect on eating disorder symptoms. in comparison, for example, with sexual abuse or physical abuse. And it's most independently associated with eating disorders. So it's the real key. It's the one that has the most impact, emotional deprivation and abandonment, really, in particular. And of course, many other schemas linked to that. Strongest predictor of eating disorder severity, childhood sexual abuse and physical abuse. I'm going to skip past that. This is eating disorder symptoms, of course, can operate as coping modes. So here we might kind of have within a fight, flight, freeze model, fawn, flop model, we've got kind of overcompensation modes where for commonly purging, laxatives, chewing and spitting, self-harm, anger turned inward would be kind of more of a fight response. The kind of flight response might be obsessional thinking, anxiety, binge eating, eating rituals, compulsive exercise, whereas more of a freeze version of kind of avoidant modes, disembodiment, disassociation. So you kind of get the picture here that the coping modes and the eating behaviors kind of fit together when we're looking at the kind of this from a trauma perspective, that this is the person's way of managing their trauma symptoms very, very often, whether it be big T trauma or little T trauma. These become, for many people, disembodied or dissociated modes that are often very fragmented. And people will often describe, you know, when they're binging, for example, you know, that's losing connection with reality or just kind of going into another realm, feeling like they've kind of been taken over in a sense by something else, by another mode where they don't really feel they're in control anymore. And this kind of fit with this view of things. So this is a slide I've stolen from somebody else. But of course, we know that it's the body that keeps the score with trauma. It's not an really a cognitive process at all. And there are all these, I guess, physical experiences and manifestations of trauma. And of course, eating disorders are linked to all of these, you know, including craving food, digestive issues, body image, a sense of body and kind of derealization, depersonalization, body image distortion, these types of experiences as well. Okay. So when we're looking at dissociation here, we're looking at, often this psychoform and somatoform dissociation. So we're looking at kind of, especially when we're looking at somatoform dissociation, this loss of bodily sensations, pain, proprioception, interoception as well, linked to the body dissatisfaction and distortion, that often the sense of the body becomes dissociated. The body with all the trauma that it contains is dissociated from as a coping response. And of course, we link this to detached protector and various other kind of coping modes in the schema model. So often, even though we, of course, in our work in schema therapy is about really trying to make these unconscious modes or these kind of semi-conscious modes more conscious. We're trying to help the person to make sense of them and to start to get those modes to dialogue, to start to help them to start to process the trauma. So the types of that's a bit of an error there. It's supposed to be avoidant protector, not avoidant surrenderer. We might also have helpless surrenderer, flagellating over controller, detached protector as coping mechanisms. And of course, a really strong inner critic, as you were saying, Rob, in the background, and this kind of vulnerable child, that this is where we're trying to get to do the processing work in schema therapy. But often the eating disorder symptoms are these kind of the way that the person has learned to try and stay away from that trauma that feels overwhelming. And it's for many clients, it feels so overwhelming that as soon as they're in touch with it, they go from 0 to 100 and where they're immediately acting out. They're immediately flipping into a dissociative state and either increasing their binging or increasing their restrictive behaviors or self-harm behavior. So it can be really tricky and risky work when you're trying to start to approach the trauma with somebody who has a history of an eating disorder. And often patients haven't developed any tolerance, because especially if the eating disorder has started in childhood, they haven't had that practice with feeling anything. They can't feel even the smallest emotions, that everything is lumped into bad, the bad category. There's the good category and the bad category of emotions, and everything from the tiniest little trigger that happened during the day at work to that trauma that happened to me in childhood are all lumped into the too big to feel, I need to binge and vomit, for example, or I need to restrict my eating to stay away from it. And in my view, there is no better drug for, if we call it a drug, for to anesthetize the impact of PTSD than an eating disorder. It is so effective at managing it. And that's why for many people, it's so hard to let go of, because they're immediately back in touch with this huge overwhelm that they experienced in childhood, and they're just unable to tolerate that.
For many, many clients.
Sorry, Rob, you only got half that sentence.
So you really see eating disorders as a kind of trauma response in many cases.
Many cases.
Yeah. So while I'm strong in the eating disorder, I don't have to deal with the trauma. I don't have to feel. I don't have to look at it.
Right.
As much, and you know. Yeah.
Exactly. If or at all, in some people's cases, you know, in some people it is so effective.
Because my whole world is the eating disorder. It's this focus. It's the preoccupations.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's my way of not feeling. And this is where, you know, with anorexia nervosa, the person restricts. Of course, over time, they have to restrict more and more and more to get the same effect, because, of course, they desensitize to that. So there has to be a kind of a ramping it up, get my weight even lower, restrict even more. So there's a sense of being preoccupied in my mind. I'm thinking about the eating disorder. I'm thinking about my next binge or my next, you know, the meal I'm going to skip. But there's also a physical element to this where the person quite literally can, you know, through their body, they become very numbed, for example. Through low weight will give that experience of numbness in the body where the person literally doesn't feel anything. Binging and purging, if it happens, especially if it's happening in a compulsive way, and for many people it's compulsive and impulsive, where they're almost doing it as, I do it every day as a way of purging all those feelings that I have experienced over the past day or the past 2 days or whatever. And as long as I do it every two, it's like an itch that has to be scratched. I have to do it so then I can carry.
So you bring up two things there, I think, if I'm not getting it wrong. One of them is sort of a self-soothing function. Yeah, as you say, to purge all the feelings, to reduce the intensity of feelings. The other one is you're almost saying it, for some it has this almost detached protector effect where it sort of puts them into a strong sort of detached state.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And for some people, it can, you know, and it can be detached protector. It can be a kind of a more detached self-soother, kind of impulsive flavor, or more of a compulsive flavor, where it's either more detached protector or an over-controller mode where the person's even having this experience of power over the body. It's almost like a bully attack mode that is turned inwards. Mm. Like, and that's where the kind of flagellating over controller is. It's like a bully attack mode that's kind of inverted.
So you've brought up little slight variations, like in how it presents, like how these behaviors present, right? Sometimes it presents with this bit more sort of self-soothing function, detached protective function, you said bully and attack function. What about, this might be a little bit controversial, so let me know about that. Sometimes it can present with a little bit of an aggrandizing flavor as well. No?
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's, I've become, because I've got power over my body, I'm so disciplined that I'm almost superior in this sense that I have control over myself.
Exactly. And, you know, there's sometimes a bit of a merger between an invincible over-controller and a self-aggrandizer.
Ooh.
Yeah, so there's this sort of, you know, I am superior to other people because I don't have, I can resist my hunger, or I don't even have hunger. And the other people, here they are, they're kind of losing control. And it's often, of course, at its root, there's this sense of feeling less than, feeling unworthy. And this is the only way in my life that this is something I'm good at.
I'm better than others at. I'm very good at it.
Right. Exactly. I'm above all these kind of needs. And
so it's not that controversial. That's what you're telling me.
though. And people will acknowledge it very often, but they're often ashamed of that as well. You know, it's less for most people.
It's covert.
It's kind of in their head. It's happening in their head, and they'll kind of acknowledge it and they'll kind of awe.
But they can mostly, if you have a good relationship, they'll share it with you and have a little giggle in a sense, no? Yeah. That, wow, I do see it this way, and it's a pardon. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a relief from, you know, because I'm getting as far away as I can as a person with eating disorder from that shameful, disgusting.
And the critic.
And little child and the critic that goes with it.
That tells me that I'm not worth anything or, you know, those kind of things. Meh.
Yeah. So that's a really hard thing to give up because, you know, ultimately giving that up, giving up the only way I have of feeling good about myself or feeling even better than
myself. Then we open up a whole other piece, which is identity.
Yeah.
Maybe that's for another book now.
Absolutely.
Because this is who I am. Like it can be exactly. On that level.
Yeah. And this is where people become very fused to their modes. This is who I am because, you know, that most people have their favourite modes that they generally over-controller tends to be the favourite and detached self-soothers kind of cast out as the bad guy. And partly what we want to help people to see, you know, especially with the kind of more binge type disorders is that ultimately, the more that they, the stronger the over-controller, the more that the person restricts. Generally, there's also in terms of more of a blowout at the other end, the more kind of losing control, which in itself for some people brings a lot of pleasure. Is that kind of pattern of restricting and then kind of binging, losing control. So it's a kind of a losing control that I'm in control of rather than a losing control that I'm not in control of, which I experienced in childhood. So it's that experience of I'll relive that kind of powerless feeling of being out of control, but I'm in charge of it this time. So a little bit on interoception, and this kind of really links in with what we were talking about earlier in terms of interoceptive difficulties occurring as a result of dissociation. So obviously if we're dissociated, we're not in touch with our bodies, we're not in touch with those interoceptive cues going on inside our bodies. And eating disorders have been linked to atypically low interoceptive sensitivity. However, it seems that is probably, and there is some research that suggests that is probably the opposite in the sense that when they're so overwhelmed by their interoceptive experience that they're dissociating as a way of getting away from that. So they're actually highly sensitive to their interoceptive experience when they're focusing on it. And this is kind of more of a dissociative effect rather than a kind of an actual deficit in people with eating disorders that they can't interpret their interoceptive signals and they're overwhelmed by their interoceptive signals rather than they have some kind of deficit or that there may be both. There's a lot of research happening in this area at the moment. But certainly, it seems interoceptive deficits seem higher in low-weight eating disorders. Again, that may well be because of the numbing effect of low-weight and the kind of more pervasive, I guess, slightly dissociative, detached state that can produce.
So that's kind of interesting. What you're saying, that there's a group of patients, mostly with anorexia, that as a part of some sort of detachment or dissociation, really don't tend to feel the hunger signals the way that regular folks would. It's, you know, it's quite detached from, because it's painful, right, to feel hungry. That's physical pain or a form of physical pain or discomfort. It's not nice to feel hungry. It's uncomfortable. We don't usually think about that. Like detached protector, we usually reserve it for more like what we might call emotional pain, sadness, loneliness, you know, fear, anger. Yeah. But you're sort of saying somehow that the detached protector seems to be wrapped up in some sort of blocking of physical pain signals or physical hunger signals.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So, and of course, you know, once the person stops eating regularly or starts skipping meals, of course, the body then learns that new pattern as well. So they'll often become hungry at certain times of day when they would normally binge in the evening, for example, but not during the day. So there's that element of the body kind of adjusting to starvation state at certain times of the day. But yeah, there's a kind of a numbing dissociated experience where the person seems to, and often for people with anorexia nervosa, those symptoms are seen as dangerous. They're seen, you know, if they've had a childhood, for example, where they have been seen as too much, too sensitive, too needy, taking up too much space, being a burden, then those interoceptive cues that tell me I'm hungry or I need something become a bad sign. They bring a lot of guilt and a lot
of trigger.
They're a trigger. They feel like I'm a bit too much. So that over-controller response to that is, you know, that I don't have needs, that taking pride in that hunger, taking pride in that of emptiness, that is a sign. Look at me. Look at how good I am at this. I'm in control.
It's a sign of strength and hyper-autonomy and not need. I don't need others. I don't even need food.
I
have no needs.
Exactly.
I'm not needy.
Uh-huh. I don't need
calories, you know, the way other folks do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've taken the hyper autonomy to an absolute extreme. And that brings a huge amount of pride, mastery, not for everyone.
I mean, the fascinating thing, Susan, when I listen to you talk about this, there's so many variations. And you get, because you get hyper autonomy, but then you get the ones who are more dependent.
And the two go together. But, you know, ultimately, There's everything has a polarity, doesn't it? You generally, say for example, an example with a client with anorexia, they may try to be hyper autonomous, but you know, the more hyper autonomous they come, where do they end up? In hospital, dependent. Where do they end up? They never leave home because they're super dependent. So it actually, like all schemas, backfires and ends up as a self-fulfilling prophecy where, you know, the more they're kind of trying to convince themselves of this fantasy that I can be hyper-autonomous, the more the actual reality is something quite different.
So sometimes too, this brings up another thing, which is the schemas, sometimes they seem to be, especially the conditional ones, on these kind of poles. So you got, you know, self-sacrifice and entitlement. And you can get people with both.
Right.
And then you get like impulse, you know, impulsivity and lack of self-control, self-discipline and unrelenting standards. So sometimes the schemas can be seen on these kind of polarities as well. It's similar to what you're saying, I guess.
Absolutely. And you can see them as kind of surrender to a core schema and overcompensation for a core schema, you know, two different coping mechanisms, I guess, in that sense, are kind of more under-controlled or over-controlled or, but yeah, ultimately it's...
Rarely medium control.
No, exactly. And one extreme leads to the other extreme. And, you know, often clients are very attached to one extreme, one mode that's at one extreme and very disdainful towards the, you know, their vulnerable self and the kind of the modes, the coping modes, especially helpless surrender. You know, most of our clients are very ashamed of the helpless surrender, ashamed of having needs, but ultimately, it's because they, you know, their denial of their own vulnerable child needs that these modes have come about in the first place. And that kind of inability to kind of nurture themselves, be compassionate with themselves.
Does it sound okay, Susan, if we went about another 10 minutes, would that give you enough time to get through the last little bit? Or do you need a bit more time?
Absolutely. I'm going to whip through a few and no, that's great. That's great. And ultimately, I always over-prepare. We don't need to cover every single slide, so that is...
And then I've got one question, actually, that someone's patched through if we get to it, yeah.
Sure, great. Okay, so just put this together. I mean, this might kind of cover some of this idea of body mistrust and interoception. That there have been a few studies that have kind of identified this kind of body mistrust, which potentially is linked to several different schemas, potentially mistrust abuse, fear of losing control, emotional constriction, being kind of core schemas, maybe vulnerability to harm, as you identified there, Rob, where the body feels unsafe. You know, it's this extreme dysregulation, you know, that comes with a lack of regulation, a lack of attunement and so forth. And then this kind of interoceptive disconnection where the person detaches through a coping mode, or dissociates through a coping modes to manage that dysregulation and that sense of overwhelm within the body through detached protector and various other coping modes. I don't know where avoidant surrender came from, avoidant protector or helpless surrender, that should be. Or through hyper-control behaviours, kind of trying to kind of almost levitate over the body as a way of trying to beat the body into submission and beat the body into kind of not having any needs, avoiding loss of control, taking pride in hyper-control and hyper-autonomy. And then these kind of more self-soothing symptoms where the person is kind of saying, well, I'm not going to get these needs met, but I can soothe myself. I can take care of myself. So it's still a form, even detached self-soother, a form of hyper-autonomy. I don't need anyone else. I'm going to stay home and binge, that kind of thing. So body image, I'm not going to focus too much on this because of limited time, but ultimately, you know, the body is experienced differently. Ultimately, the body is the container for trauma, for emotional overwhelm, for that dysregulation, often from very young infant modes, often kind of there's pre-verbal infant modes where the person's kind of never really been regulated. They've been, in some cases, and this is very common in enmeshment, of course, adultified very early on, kind of almost treated like a mini adult for many, many clients from very early on in their life, or just because of everything else going on in the family, that they've just not got their emotional needs met and sometimes not their nutritional needs met. So we could look at, for example, the inner critic internalizing an internalization of these kind of critical rejecting messages, implicit and explicit. The inner child part, of course, is that kind of felt sense of fear, shame, guilt, disgust, anger, aloneness, and so forth, associated with not getting needs met, emotional deprivation. And of course, we know with complex trauma that, we think with complex trauma, maybe would be a more moderate way of saying it, that often the hardest thing for the person, the most difficult part to process is the feeling of aloneness that they experienced. Even in the case of really severe sexual, physical trauma, is that feeling of aloneness and not being able to go to somebody to share that, to seek protection, to seek comfort, to seek validation that it happened, that is the most painful experience, that nobody got me, nobody saw me, I was invisible, I was a lost, lonely child, overwhelmed by guilt and self-disgust, anger, aloneness, anger being very suppressed, of course, and the forbidden emotion, usually in eating disorders. And then there's that kind of perfectionistic overcontroller, like levitating over the body, being thin, being perfect, trying to be hyper-autonomous, trying to beat the body into submission in some cases or to be invincible, trying to get rid of the defective, messy, unlovable body, vulnerable child that lives in the body. Invincible or flagellating overcontroller, just different versions of just different sub modes, if you like, that are just the overcontroller mode, different ways that it manifests. And for some people, the helpless surrender, where underneath is the vulnerable child, underneath is the angry child, and this kind of sickness behavior in some cases, or a way of trying to elicit or legitimize needs through the body. Not usually conscious, usually it's emerged as an unconscious or kind of a very early process where the child has learned that somehow the only way that I can get my needs met or be seen is for my outside to show what's happening on the inside. If my parent can't see my inner world, if my parent can't see my emotional self, I have to show them what I need on the outer, on my outer self. I have to show them through my body how vulnerable I am, how sick I am, how much I need the help, because to put it into words would be lead to a shaming or a guilt-inducing response. So this is the only legitimate way I can get those needs met. Okay. So I'm just going to slip through to one last slide is really just thinking about this eating disorder functioning as a way of dissociating from those and hiding those shameful, vulnerable self. And when the person says, for example, I feel fat, and there's this really great research happening around concretization of emotions. Various researchers have talked about this, Scar Derud being one of them, Petrocelli being another one, talking about how those emotions, if we don't have someone who's attuned to them or someone who can meet our emotional needs, then they become almost converted into kind of physical symptoms. They become physicalized. So when the person, for example, says, I feel fat, when any of us say, I feel fat, what do we mean by that? You know, or when I feel full or when I feel hungry, for the person often they've physicalized something that is emotional. They've tried to make sense of it in terms of something that gives them a solution as well. If I'm hungry emotionally and there's no way I can get my emotional needs met, I can fill that void inside me with food. And in the same way, you know, if I feel full and overwhelmed with my emotions, then I can address that through purging or through restricting my eating to empty myself, to make myself lighter. And just to share an example of some imagery rescripting that I did with somebody this week, where she started with an experience of fullness. We used that as our starting point in imagery. This feeling of fullness, overwhelm, it's a very big trigger for her that leads to binging and purging. And she described this feeling of fullness as a physical feeling. It linked back to a childhood experience of being kind of very deprived and feeling unable to get her emotional needs met because of her circumstances in her family. By the end of the rescripting, where I was able to reparent the vulnerable child and give her some of what she needed to help regulate her emotions and her physical nervous system state, she described feeling lighter at the end. She described it a feeling of relief, a feeling of lightness that she would normally be trying to get through the kind of purging, but she was able to get that feeling through getting those needs met and having her emotions regulated through therapy and through that imagery rescripting. So that's where we're trying to unpick in the work that we're doing with our clients, is trying to unpick what are the physical bits, what are the emotional bits. This is the I guess alexithymia, is that confusion of the physical and the emotional bits, to try and pull those parts apart and to help them to start to learn to read the book that is their own body, to know themselves, to become more trusting of their own body, the signals it gives them, to be able to eat more intuitively and trust that their body knows rather than relying on a set of rules. And to learn to experience their body from the inside out as an experience of life rather than as something that needs to be punished and constricted and controlled. So, Rob, I know I've gone over there, but I hope that kind of gives a bit of an overview.
Yeah. It's perfect, Susan. We like it when you go over a little bit. is listening because they're geeking out a little bit, so I think that's fine. So, okay, is this final slide anything that you need to go? Is this?
Yes, I just in terms of some of the clinical implications, you know, recognizing that trauma doesn't always happen with, you know, sexual abuse or physical abuse. The emotional abuse and neglect is the real key in eating disorders for many people, and recognizing dissociative coping modes and the over-identification with those coping modes as being an attempt to hold on to some kind of coherence of self, and we need to kind of help them to develop a sense of self from the bottom up, to get in touch with their vulnerability. That needs to be a kind of a non-negotiable element of therapy, knowing that the coping modes will try and take us off track. That's their job. Is to get us away from the vulnerable child. We need to be even more.
So looking at this, there's a number of things, but what sticks out to me is you're sort of saying you need to be ready to process trauma working with this group. They are typically a fairly traumatized group, and PTSD symptoms that are perhaps have been pushed down and function in that way with eating disorder often arise through treatment and will need processing at some stage. That's something you're saying, yeah?
That's what I'm saying. And I'm saying it can be very difficult work, and it can, for some people, take many years because often there's so little tolerance to the overwhelm. So it's building that up, helping them to feel little stuff first before we work out what the trauma.
And that's the second piece you've got in there, helping clients build interoceptive awareness and emotional tolerance, gradually reconnecting with the body. Okay. Couple of questions that have come through. Is it okay?
Absolutely.
And then we'll get on to all the lovely opportunities and plugging training events and things that are coming up. Graham from Queensland, one of our colleagues actually, he's talking about sort of saying he's had, you know, in the past he's had presentations where that might look like this, where there's been sort of a shift in the conceptualization of clients' eating disorder, where inner critics that might speak the language of defectiveness and punitiveness, like you're disgusting and all this kind of stuff, start to switch more to a perfectionistic type of language, such as, you know, I'm trying to help you. You just have to be better, look better, do better. All right. How would you shift the treatment approach to match this shift in how the client understands herself and eating disorder?
I would check to see, you know, what is coping and what is kind of internalization in terms of inner critic, because you want to work with and identify what those modes are afraid of. What, you know, if it's a perfectionistic overcontroller, what's it afraid of that the client will be in touch with if they're not, you know, imperfect, if they're not perfect? You know, what are the memories linked to that? Because we're always wanting to get behind. What is it they're afraid of feeling? We want to do that dialogue work with the mode. Often as well, you know, with that, if it's kind of more of a flagellating overcontroller, the client's often afraid of seeing the truth of what happened to them as a child. You know, there's an element of that I can hold on to the denial. I don't have to grieve for my childhood. I don't have to grieve for the pain of what I missed. Because if I do connect with that reality of what happened to me, then I'm going to feel a natural sense of injustice. I'm going to feel angry, and that's going to alienate me from my parent. And it means also I might lose that relationship. So there's a huge fear of anger, or a fear of seeing the truth and facing that really painful aloneness that they experienced in the past. And I think that's where we need to go, is asking these coping modes, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid will happen if she is imperfect? Often it's rejection and aloneness, abandonment, rejection and abandonment, nearly always the core of it all.
Core schemas. Okay, another one from Michelle from Queensland. I feel like you probably know all these people, to be honest. Okay, when working with patients who have anorexia nervosa / atypical AN, how do you distinguish between detached protector mode and the neurobiological changes associated with starvation syndrome? I find many of the presentations seem to overlap. Thanks, Rob and Susan, and looking forward to listening to the interview.
Well, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, in a sense, it's very difficult to differentiate. In a sense, the coping mode is using low weight as a way of numbing out. It's effective, and it's a physical experience of numbness. And you could say that the coping mode is recruiting that kind of physical experience as part of that way of disconnecting from emotions, from the body. You know, so ultimately it's as the person gains weight, and this is ultimately what we need the person to be able to do to an extent. If they're too low weight and that physical starvation state is too strong, it can interfere with the person's capacity to do the work and to retain the information. So we would need to start very slowly in that.
Partly the question too, it's this little discussion we had, right, where we were talking about the detached protector sometimes having this effect of blocking out the interoceptive awareness, you know, the physical pain signals of hunger. So partly, I guess we answered that earlier, or you answered that earlier, where we're sort of saying sometimes that is a part of a detached protector. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, and it can be therefore very scary as the person starts to gain weight, someone with anorexia, as they start to gain weight, because they're back in touch with those signals you know, for each person, that's slightly different as in terms of when it hits them, the kind of emotional impact, but also being in touch with the body, being in touch with those hunger signals and the fear of that, of those signals, especially if they've been anorexic for many, many years, being in touch with those sensations can be really, really scary for them.
Makes sense. Susan, thanks so much for dropping in and telling us about where your thoughts are at in 2025, you know, thinking through eating disorders. I know you're always thinking about it, thinking about the new angles. It sounds like you're going through copious amounts of research about things that are popping up. So we always love to check in with you every now and then about where things are at. So I'm sure we'll do that again. So come on, let's say, when's the next time I'm going to see you face to face?
Well, Rob, we're meeting in Bali for the Bali retreat very soon, which I'm really looking forward to. And the eating disorder course on Schematherapy Training Online will be running again in April. So that is coming up.
Well, actually, if I'm not wrong, that course is in July. The next one's in July. Oh. Would that make sense?
Yes.
April's closed. Yeah. So yes, the next one's coming up in July. So if you want to get on board for the next eating disorder course, schematherapytrainingonline.com with Susan. It still says course one. You know, you first set that up couple of years ago during COVID. Will you ever get around to a course two, or are you just going to keep stacking things into course one?
I have plans for course two. Coming soon.
Become this monolith course with, like, it's just got so much content in there.
Oh, I know. And, you know, I'm running a workshop in an online workshop on the 23rd and 24th of June. I've got it on the Schema Therapy Scotland website. If anyone's interested, it'll be in the Australian Perth, actually, time zone.
So that's a live workshop.
That's a live
on
online
similar
workshop.
Content, eating disorders.
Yeah. Some of that content will be converted into the online workshop too on Schema Therapy Training Online eventually as well.
Love it. Love it. So if they want to get in on there, it's schematherapyscotland.com. Does that sound right?
That's right. That's right.
Got that right. Okay. I think that's probably enough. Although I just want to quickly mention, you've mentioned attunement so many times during this webinar. I myself on our platform, schematherapytrainingonline.com, I'm running a one-day live Zoom workshop I call it Dancing with the Detached Protector. And we spend a whole day trying to work through practicing an attunement-based process, you know, for boosting your attunement in your sessions. So, folks, if they're interested in that, can jump on there as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely crucial. I think if we can't attune to people with eating disorders, you know, that's the most healing ingredient. So I think that your course is...
It's a tough thing. How do we be more attuned, you know, and what behaviours, what things can we what practices can we adopt to bring more attunement into our sessions? It's an easy thing to say, be more attuned, but it's how do we actually do that?
Well, I think part of that as well is it's very tricky when we work in a system which is requiring us to follow certain protocols for people with eating disorders to get certain outcomes, and it's very difficult to balance an outcome-focused approach, which, you know, arguably might replicate somebody with an eating disorder's childhood, where it's been very outcome and kind of, you know, achievement-focused and other people's agenda-focused. And replicate that. And ultimately, I would argue that attunement is...
And autonomy thwarting.
Yeah, autonomy thwarting. Exactly. And making sure that we're attuning to vulnerable child and not to a pseudo-vulnerable mode, I think, is the other key factor, I think, when we're working with...
There's so many angles to this, Susan. But thanks again for tuning in what is the morning over there in Scotland. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in a couple of months. So I'll see you then.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Rob.